This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Our week in review begins with a unanimous decision by the state's parole board to release a man sentenced to life in prison without parole as a juvenile 20 years ago.
Even though he went to prison at 17, he immediately threw himself into becoming a better person.
Also, Scott Brown's New Hampshire Senate campaign hits a bump amid more questions about his role advising an obscure startup in Florida.
He's an unusual guy who joins weird companies in Florida.
Plus, the uncertain future of gambling in Massachusetts. It's looking like MGM will get approval to build a casino in Springfield, but what happens if there's a vote to keep gaming out of the state?
To be asked to put all these dollars, $100 to $200 million, at risk waiting for the vote, we think is unfair and unreasonable.
And a new report says more autonomy for Boston public schools could boost school performance.
If schools are going to be held accountable for results, then resources and decision-making should be placed in the hands of those closest to students and parents. And that is principals and teachers. That's just plain common sense.
So we'll dive into all of those stories and more in our week in review. And joining us now, Callum Borchers, business and government reporter for the Boston Globe. Hi, Callum. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Good to have you, Jim.
Good to be with you.
And Jim and Cal, let's start with the juvenile parole issue, which has been a big deal for the state, and in particular, the story of Frederick Christian. This is a man who has spent the last 20 years of his life behind bars for a 1994 murder in Brockton that he was involved in as a juvenile. So yesterday, in a unanimous vote, the state's parole board decided that he should be allowed to gradually reenter society. This follows an SJC decision from last December that did away with automatic life sentences without parole for juveniles. Here's Josh Doan, the director of the Youth Advocacy Division of the State Committee for Public Counsel Services, expressing support for the board's decision to Neckin.
Even though he went to prison at 17, he immediately threw himself into becoming a better person. And he got as much education as he could. He got into all kinds of other programming and mental health counseling.
The parole board also mentioned that Christian has since received a GED. He attends AA meetings. He takes part in the prison's gardening program. But victims' families are outraged, and they're worried that Frederick Christian will reoffend once he is released. Here's Josh Doan again responding to that point.
I have no doubt that it's the right decision. There is no way to make a decision that can guarantee what's going to happen. A person who didn't look like a good bet could get out and do incredibly well.
And Cal, let's start with you. As you look at what happened this week, your thoughts about what faces the parole board and these tough decisions that have to be made?
I think one of the real complicating factors in this case, of course, was that Frederick Christian was actually not the trigger man in that case at age 17. I think that plays a big factor here. And remember, he's one of something like 60 juveniles who are currently serving life sentences in Massachusetts for first-degree murder. And many of the others are folks who actually committed the murders, you know, physically, you know, with their own hands or with pulling the trigger. And I think that is really a big caveat here, because you have to wonder how much of a precedent this is really going to set. He seems like a bit of an exception in this case, and I just wonder how that will play out down the line.
And we did hear Josh Doan just say that this man looks to him like someone who doesn't seem like a good bet to be released and do well in society. So, Jim Sturgis, do you have any sense of what you think the parole board standard should be for when it decides who gets sprung?
Well, I think in this case, I think Callum's absolutely right. He was not the trigger man. I don't know if he should be released or not. I'm not familiar enough with the case. I would say this, though. I mean, what concerns me is what happens next. He gets out. Now, we know that he's had all kinds of training within the prison system. But when he gets out, he's going to have a sort of a motivational enhancement program, a year in a lower security facility in Tennessee where he grew up, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, if you think about this, you step back for a second, our juvenile justice system is also about rehabilitation. And, you know, when you look around the world, some countries do it a heck of a lot better. You know, for example, if you go to Japan, what they do is you go to, yes, juvenile training school, you have a strict regime of daily exercise, group assemblies, academic classes, vocational training. It's all about establishing order in a younger person's mind and behavioral modification. And they also come out with skills which will allow them to actually have hope on the outside. And I don't think we've even come close to getting there for this individual or others.
And obviously what's also important is making sure that there's a support system waiting so you don't just spring open the jailhouse doors and say, welcome back, that there's a support system there. Jim and Cal, do either of you know, if you could sort of educate us, so the parole board now has to decide whether some of these men behind bars are released. Do they have any other option besides just letting people go? So, you know, for example, I think now because you can no longer automatically send a juvenile to prison without parole, you can give them a very long amount of time in prison before they get parole. But is there any in between now between just keeping people in or letting them go? Either of you know how this works?
I know that folks in the state legislature are talking about this. It's a recent Supreme Court decision and also a Supreme Judicial Court decision at the state level. So we're still in really year one of this, and I think people are trying to get their arms around that. I'm not sure of how the system, but I do know that folks within the commissions are actually thinking about
that. So complicated and quite a dilemma.
Yep.
All right. Well, let's move on and talk about former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown, now a U.S. Senate candidate in New Hampshire. He's been facing questions about his role as an advisor to an obscure Florida company called Global Digital Solutions. And sort of trying to nail down what this company does is interesting. It's a penny stock company that was originally set up to sell beauty products, then changed into a wireless data company before announcing plans to be a weapons maker. And as the Boston Globe reported just today, it has no revenue, no products, no patents, no real place of business. It paid Brown 1.5 million shares. Not clear what those shares are worth with this virtually virtual company to provide advice. So here's Scott Brown on Wednesday explaining to reporters in New Hampshire what Global Digital Solutions actually does.
They are, like many other startup companies, they're going through transition. They're trying to create jobs, ultimately come up with a plan to do so. I'm an advisor, and I'm not involved in the operations of it. Been very clear and open about it, and that's about it.
So that recording was a little muddy there, but the key point, I'm an advisor, I'm not involved in the daily operations of it, and that's about it. Brown calls it a legitimate startup, but questions about the company and his involvement prompted him to resign and relinquish the shares, saying it all become too much of a distraction. Callum, let me start with you. What's going on here? I mean, Brown backers have called all of this something that your paper, of all things, has sort of whipped up. Is that fair, or what are the questions here that need to be answered?
Well, I'll put it this way. So I cover startups a lot, Anthony, and so it's not unusual. You know, some of the red flags that come up in the traditional business sense don't necessarily apply in the startup world, right? So not having a physical office is not all that unusual for the companies that I cover. Or you know, having advisors who are not, you know, in the, well, if there was a building, would not be in the building on a daily basis and are not part of those operations. And you know, that's not really unusual either. But I think that the key factor here, though, is that, you know, at the time that he took on this advisory role in September, you know, he clearly had aspirations for public office again. And it just, I think the most surprising thing about the whole case was that perhaps his team didn't vet this company as thoroughly as it should have. You know, you look through this huge claim of a $95 million value in the pending orders for Airtronic USA, which was the company that it was planning to merge with. And then you have the CEO of that same company, Airtronic, turning around in court documents in bankruptcy court and saying it's not even close to that. It's only $1.3 million. And you just sort of scratch your head and say, you know, how did that not pop up in advance before you attached your name to this company?
And among those concerns, I guess, I mean, penny stock companies like this are hugely risky for investors. So, Jim, I'm wondering, is it appropriate or not so much appropriate, but does it look bad for a Senate candidate to be working for a company, possibly attaching his name to it and encouraging investment in such a risky company?
Yeah, let me first defend the Globe. I think Noah Berman and Todd Wallach are doing exactly what they're supposed to do, which is to dig out facts. That's what we hope they would do.
Absolutely agree with that. Yeah.
The second thing is, yes, he was an advisor, and I don't think he took it seriously enough to vet it properly. Look, he's given the stock back. There was no cash changed, I guess, cash value changed. I would say that the stock value is probably worthless at this point anyways. And I think the campaign is absolutely right. This is a huge distraction, which is a translation for, man, this is a headache, all right? But I would just note a couple things. New York Times had an interesting article on Jeb Bush, I think it was back in March, where they pinged him for exactly the same thing. He was involved in a company called Innovita. Also, pinged him for being involved with Lehman Brothers as an advisor just before the fall. You know, the governor close to home has had some issues around AmeriQuest and ACC Holdings and that sort of thing. And the problem I think I have these days is that most politicians between elected office, they figure they have to make a killing. Is if that's what they're supposed to do. And, you know, there's something about the public trust, and there's something about, you know, I want to run next and I have to show good judgment that seems to be lost sometimes, okay? So I would say Shirley Leung in her piece was absolutely right. This does raise a little bit of an issue around, did they vet it properly? Is there the kind of judgment we want to see?
Well, Callum, now that Scott Brown has stepped down from this company, returned the shares, is that it? I mean, does this issue just go away, or does it haunt him in any way in the campaign?
I guess the only haunting effect could be just sort of questioning the judgment in the first place, and I think that the point about wanting to make a lot of money while back in the private sector makes perfect sense. And as I say, this business arrangement itself doesn't strike me as unusual. There are advisors who are not paid salaries and they take on some type of cash, or rather take on a stock value in the company in lieu of that. But it just seemed like a bit of a hasty decision, perhaps. And then you just wonder, how the heck did it happen in the first place, basically.
Jim and Cal, a question for each of you about casinos. It's looking like MGM Resorts International will get the license for the casino in Western Mass, assuming the State Gaming Commission's review of MGM's proposal goes smoothly next week. But if MGM does get the green light, the company wants the actual awarding of the casino license to be delayed until the state court system resolves whether there's going to be a ballot question this November giving Massachusetts voters the option of repealing the state's casino law. And the reason for that has to do with money. Here is the president of MGM Springfield, who we spoke with, Matthew Mathis, who we spoke with earlier this week.
There are significant fees required to be paid, and we're more than happy to pay them if, in fact, we have a final award. But to pay these significant fees to only find out that the issue's really been deferred to a potential ballot vote, we find problematic.
I believe he's a Mike Mathis, by the way. I think I gave him the wrong first name. But as he said, in other words, the company doesn't want to get the license and then shell out millions of dollars for various licensing fees and real estate costs, only to have voters decide that no casinos will be built in Massachusetts after all, which seems reasonable. So, Jim and Cal, do you think the Gaming Commission would be willing to agree to slow down the process as the company wants? Yes,
just
Jim?
Sure. I think they probably will. The fact is, they've more or less settled on this anyways, and I don't think it's a reasonable expectation. Look, I'm not a big casino guy, so let's just start there. But I don't think that it's reasonable to expect them to start following through on fee payments and all the rest when there is an SJC ruling that's probably going to come at the end of this month or early July, which could impact where they have to actually wait even longer to see if they actually have to face a ballot question in November. So my guess is that's probable.
And Jim, as you and I were talking about just before we went on air, there's actually some precedent for tweaking the calendar because they have adjusted the calendar for the Revere and Everett decisions so that Mayor Marty Walsh could try to work out mitigation agreements with those cities. Cal, as you look at this process and you see the company saying, wait, let's slow down the calendar, do you view this in any way as kind of more stumbling by the Gaming Commission, which has had a rough few months for various reasons, or is this just an accident of how a court case got scheduled?
Yeah, it does appear to be poor scheduling, doesn't it? But I think that with their schedules was sort of determined before the court case came around, and they probably didn't anticipate this working out. I think that Jim is right. I mean, you'll probably end up, with a willingness to waive the fees for the time being. I mean, obviously, it would be tough to expect a company to pony up more than it's already spent. I think that Mathis said that they had already spent something like $40 million on this effort so far. So start paying fees for a casino that they never might actually be able to open would be a lot to ask. I think what's interesting, though, is that the waiting period can range anywhere from like a month to 5 months, right? Because, if there's only 1 month before the SJC decides whether it actually goes on the ballot, and if they say no, then you're just talking about a 30-day limbo period, roughly, which isn't too much to ask. But I think where things get complicated is if they say, this is actually going to go on the ballot in November, then you've got this long 5-month waiting period and presumably a heavy PR campaign by MGM to get voters to approve casino gambling.
Exactly.
Once again.
And just to clarify that, so if the SJC were to say, nope, this doesn't go on the ballot, MGM can move forward. But if it says it does go on the ballot, then MGM wants to wait until voters vote. Again, seems fairly reasonable.
Exactly. Mm.
Let's move on and talk about a recommendation this week that Boston's public schools be given more autonomy from the city's central school administration, and really raises the question, to what extent do schools benefit from more freedom? Should school administrators be given more autonomy when making the budget, staffing their schools, making decisions around curriculum? The report suggests more flexibility over things like this are only going to make schools better. Here's Dan French. He's executive director of the Center for Collaborative Education, one of the authors of the report who spoke to us earlier this week.
If schools are going to be held accountable for results, then resources and decision-making should be placed in the hands of those closest to students and parents, and that is principals and teachers. That's just plain common sense.
He says it's common sense. About a third of public schools in Boston currently have some degree of autonomy from the central office. That includes charter schools, innovation schools, pilot schools. So, Jim Sturgis, to you first. Does more autonomy automatically equal more good schools?
No. Autonomy is a necessary element, but it's not sufficient. Mm-hmm. And I think what Dan French is getting at in terms of having autonomy for classrooms, budgets, and programs is all for the good, but you also have to have strong baseline requirements for what kids have to learn and an accountability measure to make sure they're learning. And then if the schools don't perform, then you have to hold them accountable. And that's, I think, where charter schools have really outpaced. I mean, we've tried the in-district autonomies many times before, and I'm all for them. But we've tried pilot schools, we've tried Horace Mann schools, we've tried turnaround schools, innovation schools, and overall, all those schools are pretty much a wash, right? They don't have the kind of record that charter schools do. The fact is, what we're asking when we're asking for more autonomy within the district, we're asking a giant bureaucracy to somehow, of goodwill, give up power.
Mm-hmm.
They do that grudgingly and gingerly, and they take it back. I get calls from pilot school leaders with some frequency who say, Jim, the district is coming at us again. That's a problem. So I think you have to have, yes, autonomy, but you have to have a heck of a lot more than that.
The pushback here, I guess, is that too much autonomy might be a problem. I mean, what happens when a school falters? I mean, then parents, teachers, students might miss a centralized administration that can step in and fix what's wrong, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. Callum, what's your view on sort of this expanding effort to increase autonomy in public schools?
Yeah, a couple of things. I mean, in the business world, you often see sort of the reverse advice, right? So maybe you have an auditor comes into a company and looks at different departments sort of all doing their own thing and says, we need to get everybody on the same page. We need sort of a list of best practices, right? And so, you know, in the world that I'm covering a lot, that's more often the advice is standardization. And I think that that's what we've seen in schools for a long time. And perhaps there's a shift the other way. But I think one of the things that makes this really complicated is just thinking about how long it might take to see whether autonomy, increased autonomy is actually an effective tool, because I think it goes beyond just whether an autonomous school has students who are performing well on tests, let's say, because in a large school system like Boston, right, you have all of these sort of schools feeding into larger schools as kids move on for their grades. So let's just take a high school, for instance, right, that perhaps draws from multiple middle schools. And each of those middle schools, in working independently, might perform well. You know, the students might do well. But once they get to the same high school, chances are that high school is going to have a particular way of doing things that may more closely align with the way some of the students were educated than others. Hmm. So maybe students who were at a school that performed very well in middle school might get to high school and find that they actually struggle because the high school isn't doing things the way that they're accustomed to. Hmm. And so what do you make of that then? You know, if you look at the middle school just sort of on an island in a vacuum, things looked great. But it's more complicated than that when they get to high school.
What do you think, Jim?
Well, I think that Massachusetts is probably the only state in the country really that has a really strong record in this regard. It's really, in the United States, there are two conversations, what Massachusetts did and what the rest of the country has tried out. I think we struck the right balance, which was we had some level of standardization as regards the goals and the accountability. But then we told, especially in charter schools, but also in many other settings, we told the teachers and the principals, you have flexibility for getting there. We're not telling you how to teach, how to instruct this or that. That's the right balance. So I am all for much more autonomy, but you have to have some level of standardization around what your goals are, and you have to hold folks accountable in a standardized way.
Jim and Cal, you're regular guests, so you know that we like to end our week in reviews with our hubbubs, little stories that weren't on the front page, maybe we found buried in the paper. Cal, what did you spot this week?
Well, this is sort of a fun one for me because I'm over in the Fort Point neighborhood quite a lot, and it's getting a little extra art, you could say. One of the new additions to the Fort Point channel coming up in the near future is going to be something called a hydrophone.
Oh, yes.
What the heck is that, you ask? Well, it looks something like a pipe organ that somebody pushed into the water, which is appropriate near the Boston Tea Party Museum, by the way. And the idea is you've got these metal pipes that extend off of the dock down into the water, and you can sort of hit them with a hammer or something, and they'll make different tones, and it will change over the course of the day as the tide rises and falls. I'm very curious to see if folks end up sort of, you know, throwing elbows and trying to get in there and play the hydrophone, or whether everyone's very civil about it. But it sounds like a lot of fun.
I loved it, Cal, when I read that, because I was in Croatia a few summers ago, and in the city called Zadar, they have these tubes under marble steps where the sea waves go into them and make music. So I'm hoping that's what it's going to be like on Fort Point Channel. Jim, your hubbub.
Well, it's a nice day, so we're all about water today. So to your listeners who equate the latest tablet gadget or wristband gizmo with the epitome of cool, I would urge them to take a walk down to Boston Harbor and take a long, hard look at the beauty of old technology, and that's old Ironsides. This morning, the USS Constitution sailed into Boston Harbor to mark D-Day, the day on which so many Americans sacrificed their lives for freedom on Normandy's beaches, 3,000 water miles away. It is an incredibly gorgeous, majestic foremast, main mast, and mizzen mast that you can see. And there was a 21-gun salute at 1:30 today. So
it is a great resource. Wonderful it's out there. Wonderful
Absolutely.
To be able to see it.
And Anthony, yours, Anthony?
Okay, so my hubbub, I'm going to take it right from the pages of the Boston Globe today, Callum Borchers. Close race for governor. A new poll by the Globe. You know, we've seen a lot of polls that show, looks like Democrat Attorney General Martha Coakley running away with this race. But this latest poll shows a very, very tightening of a race between Republican Charlie Baker, the likely Republican nominee, and Martha Coakley to within just 5 percentage points. That's within the margin of error. So that portends a close race in the fall. One other really interesting thing that came out of this poll, though, which really shows the difference between what's going on in Massachusetts and nationally, would you say things are headed in the right direction? Big majority of Americans say no, 55 to 25. Here in Massachusetts, 44 to 40% say yes. So indication of how different things are here, perhaps, or perceptions of the way things are relative to the rest of the country. I found that interesting.
Well, my hubbub is that today is MIT commencement, so this is a big graduation weekend. The class of 1954, as its class gift, has commissioned a musical about the historic academic rivalry between Harvard and MIT. It's a love story. It tells the history of Harvard thinking, why are you establishing this narrow, niche-y little engineering school? And all the attempts to poach faculty and merge. So anyway, that's tomorrow night and Monday for anyone who wants to see the MIT rivalry.
All right. Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute, and Callum Borchers, Business and Government Reporter for the Boston Globe. Thank you both, gentlemen. Have a great weekend.
You too.
There's more ahead. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.